This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Courtney White, co-founder of the Covera Coalition, a nonprofit dedicated to building bridges between ranchers, conservationists, and others around practices that improve economic and ecological resilience in Western working landscapes. Courtney is the author of Grass, Soil, Hope, Revolution on the Range, The Age of Consequences, and The Indelible West. Courtney White is here today to tell us about his most recent book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. Welcome, Courtney.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Why did you write 2% Solutions for the Planet? What is your purpose?
So let me back up just a little bit and talk about Grass, Soil, Hope, which is a book that preceded it. And this kind of grew out of that. You know, I started a nonprofit. We're based in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We work with ranchers. I'm a conservationist. We decided, oh gosh, now 20 years ago, to try to find some common ground between ranching and conservation. Kind of fast forward to 2011, 2012, I became concerned about some larger environmental issues, climate, food, water, and began to do some research on the potentials of ranching and grasslands to sequester carbon in soils, you know, pull through photosynthesis. If you remember your elementary school biology, plants pull down CO2 and they put the carbon in the roots. So it turns out that that's a great way to potentially sequester a lot of carbon that's in the atmosphere. We've got too much of it. So in the process of writing that book, which is Grass, Soil, Hope, looking at all these different ways of putting carbon in soils, I ran across all these other stories, other cool things going on around the country, around the world, that weren't going to make it into that book. And I thought, well, let's put them together into a publication that's got, you know, fairly short chapters with pictures that kind of cross-cuts farming, ranching, conservation, technology, and all of them are low-scale, low-cost, nature-based solutions largely to these challenges that we have all around us now, food, water, and climate.
Your title is 2% Solutions for the Planet. Why 2%?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So there's three parts to that. 2% is the amount of carbon that we want to increase in the soils. And anybody who's listening is a gardener. You know that soil in your garden, when it's dark and rich, is carbon mostly. It's just as the main ingredient. So if you can increase soil carbon by only 2%, you get all kinds of good things to happen. The plants are more productive. The soil can hold more water. It's got more porosity, so it's good for drought. The mineral cycles, everything goes better when you only increase it even by just 2%. Secondly, who's going to do this work on kind of large scales? Well, farmers and ranchers comprise about 2% of the nation's population. That's what we're down to. From a much higher population years ago. So 2% of the nation for 2% of our GDP. That's a number I just kind of pulled out of the air, meaning that it doesn't cost a lot of money. For only 2% of the gross domestic product, we could have all this positive benefit for carbon and water and food done by only 2% of the population.
What are some specific examples from your book of ways to keep carbon in the soil?
Right. So there's a couple different things. My background is working with ranchers. When you manage cattle in a progressive way, it grows more grass, which then sequesters more carbon in soils. But probably the biggest thing, the biggest surprise to me when I was doing the book was in the farming section. Sometimes people ask me, what's the one thing I can do for the planet? And the answer is, we need to stop tilling. We need to stop plowing, which I didn't realize till I started doing the research. Humans have been plowing the earth for 5,000 years. But in fact, plowing has all these deleterious effects, turns the soil over, all the microbial and biological life in the soil, the nematodes and the protozoas, they all die when you turn them over. And that's why we need chemicals and soils to return the fertility. So, and all the carbon stocks that are in the soil go evaporating up into the atmosphere. So if we wouldn't till, it wouldn't plow. So in the book, I show some examples of no-till agriculture, organic no-till, cover cropping, things that keep life going in the soil. And the ranching, farming, and there's appropriate technology for this. I'll give you a quick example. It was a group of scientists in France put solar panels above their farm. And what they're trying to do was generate renewable energy and food from the same plot of land. And in Europe, they have a lot of space issues. There's not enough space. So this was, I thought, a great way of mixing technology with farming. The panels are up high so people can get under them. And they did all the science on it. It was just a really cool way of thinking about energy and food from one plot of land in hotter and drier conditions that we're starting to experience under climate change.
Would you say a few words about how cattle are being used to restore the carbon cycle?
Sure. This is a little bit complicated. So the ranchers that we work with bunch their cows up and move them around the way that nature wants herbivores to graze grass. So in North America, grazers, herbivores, animals eating grass been going on for 66 million years, not by cattle, of course, but by bison and pronghorns and other things. So the ranchers we work with mimic that behavior with their cattle. And so the cattle go through, they eat, and they leave, and they don't come back. And so the grass grows. And when you do that, grass is more productive. It puts down deeper roots. You can get grass to grow in bare soil, which then sequesters more carbon. I'll give you a quick example from the book. The Sidwells are ranchers in New Mexico who bought a very degraded, worn-out ranch, and through this cattle management brought the ranch back to life, much more productive, more diverse grasses. And even though he didn't measure carbon, he doesn't think of himself as a carbon rancher, I know that he's sequestering more carbon now than he did before because he's got so much more grass growing on the ranch.
What are some examples from 2% Solutions for the Planet of ways to intensify food production sustainably?
Right. And that's sort of the big question. Water and food. How are we going to deal with this large population on the planet expected to rise from 7 to 9 billion in only about 20 more years? So the question is, how do we sustainably increase food production? Well, the industrial ag has their answer, more GMOs. Well, I don't think we should do it that way. So I'll give you an example from a rancher in New Mexico named Sam Montoya, who took 93 acres of land on a Native American reservation. He put 33 paddocks, or he fenced the 93 acres into 33 pastures, essentially. And then he moves his cows around those 33 pastures every day. So in 33 days, they go all the way around the circle. And he's grown all this grass, and he's increased the size of his herd. So he went from about 50 head of cattle to 220 head of cattle in the same amount of acres, only 93 acres. It's irrigated ground. And that's about double the stocking rate for irrigated ground generally. So he's increased the intensification of the food production sustainably, because it's just cattle's eating grass and walking around the circle. And it's produced a lot of food from a small part of land. And so there's an example of how, through good management, good stewardship, you can increase the amount of food you produce from the same plot of land than you could with conventional means.
Would you also speak about the Singing Frogs Farm in California, where the owners do year-round farming?
Yeah, this was another surprise to me. Again, farming is something I had to kind of learn a lot about. So this is a farm near Sebastopol, Northern California, north of the Bay Area. That's a young couple, the Kaisers, who farm year-round. Literally, they don't stop in the winter. And the idea being that, in fact, he said to me when I was there, where this idea came from that we have to stop farming, because then he stops making money and there's all the shutdown costs and startup costs. So what he does on his farm is that he hothouses the food. So he grows them from seeds into small plants. When it's time, he pulls the vegetable, the broccoli, whatever, out of the ground. He puts another plant back in, composting it very carefully, and then he just continues to grow food. So he has a CSA. It's an organic farm. So he's selling locally to his members. He's making the income year-round. He's able to employ 4 people full-time, doesn't rely on seasonal help. And he's producing food 12 months a year. And I asked him, can you do this anywhere? And he said, absolutely. It's more of a mental thing than a practice or a physical thing. It's just deciding that we're going to keep growing food year-round. It's cover cropping. He's got hedgerows for beneficial bees. It's organic. He's building carbon in soils. He's doing all the right things. It's called Singing Frogs Farm. If anybody wants to check them out, Singing Frogs Farm near Sebastopol, Northern California.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Courtney White, author of the book 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. Would you tell us about examples from your book of gaining benefit from growing different types of plants together?
Right. So nature likes to mix it up. It likes all different kinds of things to grow together. So annual plants, annuals are things that come up every year and then die back. Perennial plants, so grasses are perennials. Humans decided a while back that we wanted to separate everything into nice, neat rows, separate the animals from each other. But nature jumbles everything together. And so there's a story in the book about a farmer in Australia, Eric Harvey, who decided that he wanted to run cattle and sheep together as one unit. He saw it in Africa somewhere, I believe. And so he came back to his farm and put 600 head of cattle and I think 5,000 head of sheep together in one herd. It's called a flurd, a flock of sheep and a herd of cattle, a flurd. And humans don't do that. They keep the cattle separate from the sheep. And Eric said, why? Why not put them together? It's one unit. They eat different things. There's different manure, you know, that kind of stuff. And so he put them together. He moves them every day. And he's had a tremendous positive ecological effect as a consequence. Kind of, again, that large herd moving across these landscapes. So there's an example of kind of mimicking natural processes for food production, for grass growth. Another example, a farm in Kansas that cover crops, meaning that they don't let land get bare even during the winter. They always have a green crop or some sort of cover growing. And on Gail Fuller's farm, he likes to grow all kinds of stuff among the corn. So he's got the corn growing, and in the middle he's got weeds and he's got other stuff all covering the soil. He says nature likes it. He's productive. He's organic. It's no-till. It's kind of all of the above. It sounds crazy, but he makes it work. And again, nature likes things all jumbled up. And when you do that, there's more minerals in the soil. There's more carbon in the soils. The microbes are happier. And he doesn't have to use any chemical.
Would you comment on the Oklahoma Food Cooperative?
Sure. This is a very interesting model. This is in the technology section. What kind of a technology? And the question I was asking in that was, what does local mean if you live on a farm or ranch far from a city? We're used to farmers markets and farmers and ranchers coming into the city to sell their goods at a farmers market. But what if you live far away? So Oklahoma, a group of folks got together and said, let's try a different model. And so they used the internet to create kind of a buyer's network where folks who want food from particular farms and ranches can go on the internet. It's a window of time. It opens, you place your orders, the window closes, the orders are sent to the producers who bundle the food together, and then someone comes and picks it up and drives it to Oklahoma City where they rebundle it and then they send it back out to the consumers. So the farmer and rancher doesn't have to drive hours and hours to get to a farmer's market, spend a night in a hotel, do all that expensive stuff. They can stay on the farm, concentrate on producing, and the food still gets to the consumer exactly what they want. And it's been a success. It's grown rather dramatically. It includes a lot of non-food, but it's all Oklahoma-made products. And it's a good example of technology, in this case, the internet, helping farmers and ranchers meet new customers.
What are some examples from your book of 2% solutions that help restore ecosystems?
Right. There's a whole section called restoration, and this comes out of our work in New Mexico trying to restore some damaged ecosystems. We have a fair amount of damaged land. Most of it is historically damaged, meaning way back when the grazing was not done well or the forests were not allowed to function properly. So we have a lot of erosion, a lot of land health issues. So we began work with a man named Bill Zedike, who came up with a restoration methodology that uses nature-based stuff, so rocks and sticks, and put in creeks to re-meander them. And kind of a long story, but basically if you get the creeks back up to health, all kinds of collateral, cool ecological things flow from that. Grass grows, riparian vegetation grows, then more carbon is stored in soils, and kind of a cascading effect, a beneficial effect when you start getting these systems back into health. So there's a number of stories in that chapter that deal with restoration. How do we restore these damaged systems for all kinds of benefits? And animals can be part of it, meaning livestock can be part of it, or it can just be kind of just getting in the creek and getting mud on your shoes and working to restore these systems to health.
Would you speak about the poop and stomp approach to restoring a mining site?
Right. This was a project in New Mexico. I got a call one day from the EPA administrator who said, I've got some extra money. You got any restoration projects that we could do? And I said, you know, I've heard of one. So I called this rancher up in Arizona, Terry Wheeler, who was using cattle to reclaim mine tailings. And mine tailings are a big problem. You know, these big mines in the West that they dig up the stuff and they just dump it out outside. And that stuff erodes, it goes into the creeks, it's got a lot of sediment problems. And these mine companies are required to reclaim this land. They can't just sit there and erode. So they've gone through all these different strategies, chemicals and this and that, to try to get this stuff stable. Terry said, I got an idea. So he got a herd of cattle together, about 40, and then he builds an electric fence pen on the mine tailing, and he puts down seed, and then he throws down hay, and he turns out the cattle. And the cattle are eating the hay, and they're stomping on the seeds. And so he liked to say, if you're a gardener, what does it say on the back of the package? Press seed firmly into soil. So he's doing that on these mine tailings, but with cattle. So their hooves are pushing those seeds in the soil, and then there's carbon in the form of the hay, and then there's manure and all that stuff that happens. When the rains come, grass grows. And so he can revegetate a barren mine tailing with nothing more than seed, hay, and cattle. And that's why we call it a poop and stump.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Courtney White, author of the book 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP, 90.3 FM by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. What are some examples from your book of using 2% solutions to protect wildness?
Right. And part of what I wanted to do at the end of the book was, you know, I'm a conservationist by background. I wanted to make sure we didn't leave nature and particularly wild animals out of this discussion. When we talk about sustainability and we talk about climate and we talk about food, it's almost always kind of around farming issues or ranching issues or restoration kinds of things. And it turns out that not only can we learn a lot from nature, there's lots of opportunities to partner with nature for these things. So, for example, the first chapter in that section is about beavers. Beavers are a keystone species in the West. We trapped them out historically, which really unraveled a lot of these systems ecologically. But they have figured out that beaver dams and the soils behind beaver dams are full of carbon. And if you want to sequester carbon in soils, letting beavers do their thing is a great way to start. And then there's all kinds of collateral positive things that beaver dams do. I know a lot of landowners don't like beavers, but they largely misunderstand the role that beaver play in these systems. They're really actually an important species. If you kind of just get over the fact that they do pull down trees, there's all kinds of things that they do to the system. Another example is dung beetles. And dung beetles are nature's sanitation crew. If a land is healthy and functioning properly, dung beetles will be there. And they'll go over there and whatever poop is on the ground, they'll roll up into balls and bury. That's what they do. They're dung beetles. And this has all kinds of cool effects. It takes that manure, puts it underground. So that's carbon going underground. They aerate the soil for water and rain that comes. And they do it all for free. So dung beetles, beavers, there's a chapter about bears and birds. You know, kind of all these different ways of looking at nature, working collaboratively, coexisting with wild species. They also can benefit these larger challenges that we face.
Would you also mention the work with bats to provide water for them?
Yes, bats. Yeah, you bet. So this was based on a bat biologist that we know in New Mexico who's done really an interesting job of working with landowners or with ranchers to get them to configure their water tanks for bats. Bats need water, obviously, especially in dry country, but they need to swoop. They don't land and drink. They swoop in and drink. So reconfiguring and designing water tanks, troughs for livestock that are bat-friendly is a win-win. So the water is there for the animals and the bats can swoop in and get their water and fly away. And so especially in drought under climate change where water becomes a scarce resource, here's a win-win. And it's a good example of working collaboratively with nature, not setting ourselves against nature. We got to stop this. We got to kill this. And it's a very simple kind of redesign. He spent a lot of time working with ranchers who love nature. I mean, they love wildlife. Many of them just need sort of new ideas like this. Oh, so that's how you redesign a water trough to make it bat friendly. And so there's a conservation group working with private landowners for the benefit of wildlife and domesticated animals at the same time.
Do you have a favorite example or examples from your book of a nature-based practice for combating hunger, drought, and climate change?
Well, there were some that surprised me that I didn't know about, which I thought were pretty interesting. For example, some of the technology that's come down the road to help us solve some problems. So composting has got some challenges. They've now got some technology that can sort of speed up that process. I guess my favorite, I'm trying to think of my favorite story. I profile a farmer in New Hampshire named Dorn Cox, who took over his family's farm. And they were organic farmers, but he took it over and kind of raised it a level, thinking about carbon and climate. And I love something that he says. He says that farming isn't rocket science. It's more complicated than that. And what he's saying is that it's not our grandparents' farming anymore, a young guy. So he uses the internet, he uses computing power, he monitors and measures everything on the farm very carefully, trying to get carbon in the soil, so he measures the carbon content. He's networked through the internet with other farmers. They've started a grain cooperative. He likes the power of computing to analyze the data. Then he open source shares it with other farmers. He's built a biodiesel machine to run the farm on biodiesel that he grows plants, sunflowers and canola plants. So he's really thinking about all these issues. So he's producing organic food like his parents did, but he's off the energy grid largely, and he's sequestering carbon in the soils, and he's working collaboratively with neighboring farmers. So it takes all that up a big level, and it's a very hopeful way of dealing with these issues at the grassroots level.
Would you also comment on how cattle are being used to control invasive species?
Yes. So there's a story about in there called Cows Eat Weeds. And out west here, I think many folks probably don't realize we have a big weed problem. These are invasive, noxious, often foreign weeds introduced historically in the West. A lot of them are very aggressive. They can take over from native vegetation quickly. It's a problem. Something like the size of Delaware we have in the West every year, more weeds are spreading. So the agencies and conservation groups are worried about this. How do you fight weeds? Most of them use herbicides and chemicals and, you know, nasty stuff to kind of kill these weeds. So there's a person, Kathy Voth, in Colorado who got the idea, you know, animals will eat weeds. And she started with goats and then she shifted over to cattle. And it's a very simple process where she teaches them to eat weeds. Weeds are nutritious. They're green. They have a lot of nutrients in them. Cattle will eat them if they get trained to them. It's pretty simple, but most ranchers, conservationists don't think about cows eating weeds. Cows don't eat weeds. Yes, they do eat weeds. They can be trained to it, and it's good for them. And now they go out and eat weeds, and you're growing animals for a food system. It's organic. And that's sort of the whole point of the book, is that there's a lot of innovation out there. There's a lot of bright new ideas at grassroots levels. If you just kind of rethink things, we can accomplish a lot if we put our mind to it.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, you know, I wrote the book largely trying to present an alternate narrative to the larger doomy and gloomy scenarios we have out there about the planet and the climate. And I wanted folks to say there are small-scale nature-based solutions to these problems. We don't have to go to huge geoengineering schemes. We can actually can work at small scales that have all these collateral benefits. I want folks just to understand that these practices exist. And I wrote the book in such a way that you can follow the stories, you can dig deeper, find new resources. Any particular story that you wanted to follow, you can follow it.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I'd like folks to understand that, especially folks who live in cities, that we need to partner with progressive, sustainable, rural operations. So farms and ranches that are doing cool stuff. Because people ask me all the time, what can I do? You know, what can I do? I live in a city, what can I do? Well, everyone eats food, everyone drinks water. So they can get their food from a ranch or a farm that's doing this good work, and they're out there is more than ever. And then also think about where your water comes from and what we can do to try to improve these watersheds. And that's how folks can vote with their paychecks and, you know, their money and their dollars, particularly get engaged with the eco-agricultural movement that's out there.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, I greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
You were just listening to Courtney White, author of the book, 2% Solutions for the Planet, 50 low-cost, low-tech, nature-based practices for combating hunger, drought, and climate change, published by Chelsea Green Publishing in October 2015. For more information, check on the web at awestthatworks.com. Again, that's awestthatworks.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on kexp.org.